comprised of the sea road, the train station car park, the tracks, and the retaining wall beyond. As the tide moves in, and the water level rises with a speed that looks unnatural, an insupportable anxiety is triggered in me. I can see the railings that stand between the tracks and the sea, but I cannot see the land beneath, the dun-colored beach, rippled and unpretty, or the desultory outcropping of rock beyond. And the station and the intermittent trains appear to be floating. This uneasy fascination with the sea has been with me since childhood. Every summer, when I was growing up, we visited my grandparents at their vacation place down the Oregon coast at Agate Beach. The house was a three-bedroom clapboard with a wooden porch that they rented out when they weren't in it, humble in comparison to the fancy vacation homes that were slowly growing up around them. It sat high on a bluff, and to get to the beach, we had to descend a pine-shaded, zigzagging path that opened onto a huge expanse of white sand beach, which seemed, in its suddenness, like a moment out of a fairy tale, the very embodiment of possibility and wonder. Fog could roll in without warning, though, and often a bright, clear morning would turn misty and damp within minutes, so that a slight anxiety attended even the finest of days, a watchfulness that I often think persists in people who have grown up in fickle climates. The Pacific at that latitude was cold, but my mother used to plunge in regardless, gliding like a seal, her head held stiffly above the swell, as I knelt digging in the sand beside my grandparents, or waded in knee-deep to watch her, fearing for her life since the day I heard her say to her mother, laughing and shivering as she toweled herself off, "That water would stop your heart." Around the time that I was entering adolescence, my grandparents came less and less often to the beach, until they no longer came at all. The slope was too treacherous for them. When I was 16, my grandfather died. And for the final 2 summers before I went off to college, the same year my grandmother sold the house and moved into a retirement home, it was just women on those visits. My mother and grandmother and me, and sometimes a girlfriend or two I'd brought along. We would sit round the fireplace at night, so rural and easy, but conscious, too, of the men who were not with us. Years later, when my mother and Stan visited Eddie and me in Ireland after we were married, I took her to the beach at Ross's Point. It was early June, just the two of us. Stan had gone golfing with some men Eddie had introduced him to, and Eddie was working. As we descended the slope from the car park to the long second strand, my mother stopped and put her hand on my arm as though she had seen an apparition. "What is it?" I said. She took a deep breath and looked up and down the beach, surveying the horizon. Then she put a hand to her chest and patted herself consolingly. "Are you okay?" "I'm fine," she said, and for a moment said nothing more. When she had recovered herself, she told me that she had just experienced a sense of déjà vu so powerful she felt a bit unsteady. "Something about the beach," she said, "the precise elevation from which we were overlooking it. Something about the weather, too, which was changing as we stood there. Just a minute ago, the sun had been out, and it looked as though the day was going to get steadily brighter, but low, pewter clouds were now gathering above the water." She had felt transported, she said, right back to her parents' beach house, to that moment of approaching the top of the trail, before you descend through the trees, when you could see the beach and the sea spread before you. "Do you remember that?" she said. "Of course I do." We stood looking out over the strand until the thing that had come upon her seemed to pass, and I felt her beside me again, in the here and now. As we started down the path, I hooked my arm through hers. "Don't lose me," she said. It was an old phrase of mine from childhood. "Don't worry," I said, and steered us toward the water. "Let's put our toes in." At the water's edge, we took off our shoes. A warm wind was blowing. Across the inlet, we could see the shoreline at Lissadel, and to the north, the mountain behind our house. I traced an arc through the water with my foot and said, "The cold would stop your heart." "It's not so bad," my mother said, and I knew that she didn't remember. I told her then how I had lived in terror of her heart stopping whenever she was in the ocean, and instead of laughing, she looked genuinely distraught. "Why didn't you tell me?" she said. "I don't know," I said. And I didn't. There are many things like that in childhood. Fears that could easily be allayed, but which, in the overly literal realm we inhabit as children, make too much sense to question. It wasn't hard to believe that the icy water that sent needles of pain up my calves might also be sending similar and deadly shards into my mother's heart. During the last year of her life, when we went to the beach near her condo, she wouldn't go in the water. The Gulf was calm, but she didn't trust her balance. She said if she fell, she would not be able to get up. Once, she let me lead her. I held her arm, and we stood in water not even to our knees, and she looked happy. But then a small wave lapped against our shins, and she tottered slightly and said, "Whoa." After that, she demurred whenever I asked her to come in with me, and while I swam in the calm shallows, she sat under the beach umbrella, watching me so anxiously I felt I was torturing her. Once, not long into the affair, Eddie and I were in the car when I heard Collie's voice on the radio. I had a moment of dissociation, in which I was not sure if the voice was in my head. I often imagined what Collie might say to me about this or that, followed by another moment in which I wondered, ridiculously, whether he might say something that would give us away. We were coming home from Eddie's parents' house. Celia and Jerry had had their first baby 3 weeks before. Ethan was his name, and they had driven down to Sligo to show him off. We'd walked into the sitting room, and Celia was in a big armchair, holding him. Jerry and Eddie's mother were bent over, eyeing the baby rapturously, and Eddie's father was to the left, leaning forward in his wheelchair. Everyone was silent, struck dumb by the miracle of Ethan blinking. "Ah, come in," Celia said when she saw us. "The little guy is dying to meet you." She handed the baby to Eddie, who took him and rocked him gently, with a naturalness that surprised me. When he turned and offered Ethan to me, I panicked. I felt suddenly frail and shaky, the sort of person you wouldn't hand a baby to in a million years. But I couldn't possibly refuse. So I took him, and everyone looked on with their beatific smiles. The impulse to drop the infant was strong. I don't mean I wanted to, of course, but it was one of those unbidden urges, like veering into oncoming traffic, or pitching yourself off a mountain path. Some part of me wanted to drop the baby and just come clean, because it was too much, the way they were all smiling at me, the way they'd entrusted me with this baby of theirs, as though I were someone who could be trusted with anything at all. "Isn't that Kevin's pal?" Eddie asked, as we turned up the mountain road. The show's host had just mentioned the names of his guests, Collie and two others, who were there to discuss the future of the Abbey Theatre, the one you met in Dublin that time. I had told Eddie I was meeting Collie for coffee before going to the hospital to interview the psychologist. The idea had been to carve out a plausible space in my life for Collie to inhabit, though I could see now it would have been smarter to say nothing. I pretended I hadn't been listening. "Oh," I said vaguely, and looked down at the radio. "You're right, it is. Did you ever hear back from him? Wasn't he going to set you up with some contacts?" "No," I said. "I never heard back from him." Eddie gave a little snort. He had a particularly low opinion of people who made a show of saying they'd do this and that for you, and then didn't deliver. "I should have followed up," I said. "I didn't follow up." We listened for a minute. Then Eddie said, "He sounds full of himself." Collie went on and on. I felt an intimacy with him that was making me queasy. I had to resist the urge to turn the radio off. It was unbearable. Collie's voice filling the car as though he were in it, and Eddie trying to talk to me about him, and me thinking, how could he not know? How could he possibly not know? I reached over to turn the volume down, and my hand was shaking. We met maybe a dozen times in all, when Eddie was traveling, or if I managed to secure some freelance assignment that took me to Dublin. A few times I simply lied. I was meeting an old college friend who was passing through, or an editor I hoped to work for. Or I was researching some vague story idea. On every one of those occasions, when I left our home, I imagined that when I returned, all would be changed. Whatever vague intimations Eddie was feeling would crystallize, and he would grasp the truth. I thought that only in my absence could Eddie see me clearly, and each time I set out for Dublin, eager as I was for Cawley, I had to resist the urge to turn back. And yet, once I was there, I found it hard to drag myself away. Soon Cawley was having to persuade me to hurry to the train station, for my own good. I was losing track of what was and wasn't prudent. Once, we argued over whether or not I should accompany him to the Abbey. It was an opening night, and he was reviewing the play. There would be a lot of people there he knew. And apart from the occasional drink in Dublin, we didn't do public outings together. I had told him the day before that I would see him at the flat after the play. I actually relished the idea of hanging around Coley's place on my own. I imagined myself, stretched out in his bed, awaiting his return, feeling kept and illicit. But when I got to Dublin that afternoon, we immediately made love, and as we lay there afterwards, playful and sated, feeding forkfuls of leftover bolognese to each other from a bowl on the bed between us, I decided that I wanted to go to the Abbey after all. I said, "We could easily be friends, you know. It's not like it's the 50s. Cawley leaned across me to put the bowl on the floor and said, "I thought we agreed it wasn't a good idea." "Someone there you don't want me to see?" He propped himself up on one elbow and ran a finger down the length of my chest and belly. "I'm not going to dignify that with a response. That sounds like something my mother would say." He smiled. "Well, you've always spoken well of your mother." "I'm serious," I said. "I want you to come. It would be lovely. But we decided against it for a good reason." I continued to protest. I felt a desire to be reckless, and yet I wasn't sure I wanted to win the argument. I wanted it both ways, for our secret to be protected, and for us to be seen together. In the end, I convinced him to bring me to the theater. We readied ourselves in the flat, dressing and primping, and sharing an iceless G&T. The normalcy of it thrilled me. At the theater, we had a drink in the lobby before the play started, and anyone Cawley knew, he introduced me to as a journalist, and he looked at me whenever I spoke, with the sort of studied attention we direct at people in whom we are only politely interested. It was only in the theater, when the lights went down, that he touched me, took my hand, and placed it on the inside of his thigh, and whispered in my ear that he wanted to be home and fucking me. The following day, as though alarmed by what we'd done, we didn't leave the flat. We ordered a Chinese and lay in bed watching Goodfellas on video. And Cawley told me about the time he went to New York. He was 19 and had gone to stay with a cousin in Queens, thinking he might never come back. He was going to melt into the crowd and live by his wits and make his way in the theater. His eyes got that glazed, faraway look I saw in even the most sophisticated, the most jaded of Irish people when they talked about New York. "I loved it," he said. "I loved New York." But then his cousin's lease was up, and the landlord was going to gut the place. Cawley's cousin moved in with his girlfriend, and Cawley bunked for several weeks with some bricklayers from Clare, tended bar, and, over one sweltering summer, whittled his savings down to nothing, and met no one at all from the theatre world. "I came back with 7 quid in my pocket," he said, then smiled. "But I'd lost weight." "I can't believe you never told me this," I said. I wanted it all to happen fast, and when it didn't, I lost my nerve. It embarrasses me, actually, how quickly I gave up. "Well," I said, "you'll go back." He didn't answer. He stared at the ceiling like someone whose one good shot was behind him. I nudged him with my knee, and he turned to me and kissed me hard, his teeth on my lip, his hand reaching around my lower back to press me to him. I had a ticket for the evening train. It was nearly 5 o'clock, the sun coming in full across the bed, the air swampy with heat and the sweat of us, and all I could do was lie there. I felt thick as syrup. I knew that if I didn't go, a cascade of consequences would follow. But just then, I was incapable of caring. I was like someone with heat stroke or hypothermia. The life-saving thing in view, and unable to rouse myself to reach for it. Collie said for the third time, "You have to get up, sweetheart. You're going to miss your train." "I know," I said, and I was grateful to him for keeping us on track. But only momentarily, for in the next instant I thought, why was he so keen for me to leave? Where was he going? With whom? Sometimes he seemed so sad in his life, waiting there for me like a child. Other times, I imagined that the minute I left him, he opened the door and a party poured out. Between encounters, we wrote letters to each other. It seems extravagant now. The exchange of letters, as though we had the leisure of aristocrats. I say Collie wrote me letters, and it sounds like an affectation, like he was showing off. But it was just what people did then. What a commitment it seems now. The gathering of all that gear. The pen, the stationery, the envelope, the copying out of the address, and the licking of the stamp, and then the effort of filling all those pages, the laborious scrawling that sends twinges up my wrist even to contemplate. But we had no choice. Phones were a problem. Collie didn't have his own, just a payphone in the hallway outside his bedsit. The age of the mobile had not properly dawned, and none of us had email yet. The first of the two times Collie phoned the house, a few weeks into the affair, Eddie was right there. It was midday, a time when Eddie was never home. I answered, then, constricted with fear at the sound of Collie's voice, which seemed to rise an octave and go thin, now heartrendingly unsure of itself, for he had heard the hesitation in my own voice. I spoke a few stilted non-sequiturs that must have sounded ridiculous, even to Eddie, and cut the conversation short. And if there was a moment I felt most strongly the cheap, diminishing effect of adultery, it was that one. The post arrived in the late morning, when Eddie was gone to work, and the breakfast things were put away, and the day yawned like some other life I could tumble into. It was the first true summer in 6 years, the first since the year of my arrival, though the heat and the light seemed in a different key entirely. It should have been an idyll, the laburnum coming into its own, and the glen bathed in sunshine, and Eddie and I languorous as honeymooners, enjoying perhaps our last summer unencumbered by children. Instead, it felt infernal. The buzzsaw drone of insects wrongly loud. The light seemed wrong, too, sharp and hard, like light in the desert. By midday, the road to our house would be blistering in the heat. Every day, I thought of my first summer with Eddie, the soft, purple-gray skies of midnight, and the clarity with which he loved me. I had begun to believe that I had fallen in love with Eddie in part because of the way that he loved me. But if so, was that wrong? I still don't know. Because in loving him for that, I was loving his capaciousness, his ability to accept me as I was, his refusal to be discouraged by my shortcomings or inconsistencies in my character. He was like an example of love, and I envied him his certainty. I thought it might rub off on me. Nothing I had done, or ever might do, seemed to alarm him, and nothing was required of me in the way of change. It was the antidote to the feeling that had nagged me since childhood, instilled in me by my father's absence. The feeling that true home was elsewhere, off in the mythical distance, the belief that if things were going to come right, some change was required of me, the nature of which was maddeningly obscure. Each morning, when Eddie's car disappeared down the laneway, I felt a shameful relief, and then the anticipation would begin. Around 11, a letter would come, or it wouldn't come. If there was nothing, I felt safe leaving the house and getting on with my day. If a letter did arrive, I would sit on the front steps, the wave of a mountain breaking behind me, and the bay glistening in the distance in front, and the garden awash in sunlight. A light that seemed no longer accusatory, or even familiar, but like an element from another realm entirely. I would hold the envelope unopened for as long as I could bear, my hands trembling with excitement, but also with the previous night's successes. For Eddie and I had no idea how to hide from ourselves that summer, and so fell back on the things we knew, the late nights and the revelry of our beginnings, which in their first instance had had the feel of celebration, but which we now relived as bad theater. Inside, on Eddie's desk, was one of those shiny letter openers. But out of some flimsy notion of honor, I never used it. Instead, hooking my index finger in the little gap at one end of the envelope, and running it to the opposite end, producing a ragged furrow that looked like agony itself. I can still see Cawley's handwriting, schoolboyish and deliberate, which contrasted sharply with the prose. A torrent of ideas and sentiments that seemed to contain all the energy of his person. Each letter was a welter of allusions. To public things, things between the two of us, things meaningful only to himself. It was part of what drew me to him. I wanted to gather him in, to get at whatever was underneath the performance, under all that exclamatory bonhomie. I wanted to see him weep, not over me, but over the past, his parents, life, whatever he'd failed at or feared, the whole sad, fucked-up story. I wanted to see him grow small and helpless and racked with suffering, and then to gather that suffering up and rock it like a baby. What is it with women, our way of looking at men like they are prisoners we've been tasked to break? I suppose it should embarrass me now, to remember the hours that summer that I whiled away just thinking of him, drifting idly about the house, wallowing in love as though it were indeed my whole existence, its interior labors actual demands upon my time. But it doesn't embarrass me. Not as much as other things I did. In fact, I feel astonished, and a tad nostalgic, to recall the frittering away of entire days. Did I believe we had a future? I honestly can't remember. I remember the way he made his A's, squat and nearly square, but I cannot recall whether I actually thought it might work between us, what I wished for, or thought possible. I lived in the now, as though the affair were a terrible crisis in which the intensity of the present and its demands simply effaced, for some necessary interval, any consideration of the future. But I must have thought about it. I must have thought about little else that summer. It is just after 10 when we step outside the cinema on Eustace Street. A desultory bit of snow catches us both by surprise. "Oh," we say, looking up. "What's this?" Harry says, smiling at me, delighted. It is perhaps my favorite thing about Harry, that quick access to delight. He looks as though he has never seen anything quite so magical as these few aimless flurries drifting down upon Temple Bar on a night in March. We didn't go to the cinema together, and it was only halfway through the film that I noticed him, two rows in front of me, and over on the far left, alone. He was utterly engrossed, his head tilted back slightly, his face catching the glow of the screen. And in the dark, in the intimacy of the cinema, I felt I was spying him in a private moment. Afterwards, I waited for him in the lobby, and when he saw me, he lifted his eyebrows in greeting and gave me a reluctant little smile. There was something sad and subdued about him, and I thought maybe I'd been wrong to wait. The film was about a couple in their 80s who'd been together forever. They lived in an apartment in Paris. One day, the woman suffered a stroke. The prognosis was that she could expect more strokes, a rapid deterioration in her mental and physical condition. She made her husband promise he wouldn't leave her in a hospital to die. As the weeks and months passed, she grew more disabled, more demented. She lay on the bed in her nightdress, and her husband exercised her leg. 9, 10, 11, 12. The nightdress slipped to reveal the skin of her thigh, mottled and unsightly. In another scene, he watched her being showered by a nurse. Her slack breasts, the folds of her belly. There was no aversion in him. Simply the frank gaze of a lifetime. At the film's end, when his wife was capable of little but lying on the bed and moaning, hurts, over and over, he suffocated her with a pillow in a terrible act of mercy. Harry and I decided to walk up to the Central Hotel for a drink. I scoot round to the right side of him, the side opposite his walking stick. His bad leg seems not to belong to him, like a slightly awkward bundle he is toting. It turned out I was wrong about it being polio. It was a botched back operation, when he was in his early 30s, that was meant to deal with some damage to his discs. Afterwards, they told him he'd never walk again. Irish healthcare in the 80s, he said. You don't want to know. He'd spent 6 months in a wheelchair, then nursed himself, his neurons, back to some kind of working order. He said he'd stand by the fireplace, clutching the mantle with one hand, timing himself with the stopwatch. 10 seconds today, 12 tomorrow, and so on, until he was able to stand with just the walking stick, and then to walk. Does it hurt? I asked him recently. Your leg? And my back. He said he gets shooting pains down the right side of his body, sometimes down his arm. His knee is bad. There are places it's nearly bone on bone. We find an empty sofa in the hotel bar and order 2 glasses of red wine. Well, he says brightly. What did you think? He has recovered himself. He no longer looks caught out and is ready to discuss the film's artistic merits. It was a proper love story, I say. He did the worst thing, the last thing he could ever have imagined doing, because she'd asked him to. Did you like it? It was unrelenting. I liked it very much. We agree. Watching the film was like watching death slowly bearing down on you. There was something beautifully, horribly true about it. They won't like it in America, Harry says, a bit gleefully. Another thing Harry enjoys, the gormless, adolescent optimism of America. Harry is an old soul. European through and through. No, I say, probably not. He looks to his left. He's caught sight of someone he recognizes. And just like that, I remember. Harry standing in front of the shell of a burnt-out house. Hey, I say. I remember. The assessment in Kosovo. I remember meeting you. Harry turns back to me. Don't try to flatter me, he jokes. It's too late. I do, I say. I'm serious. I'm sorry it took me so long. I don't think we really spoke. We were introduced, he says. They had just killed a bunch of dogs in the next village. Do you remember that? I have to think for a minute. Yes, I say. Vaguely. I had a way, back then, of forgetting things that didn't make it into my reports. My memory became weirdly utilitarian. My entire relationship to events grew strange, in fact. When I'd first arrived in Kosovo, I had wanted to imbue my reports with feeling, outrage or sorrow, which was exactly what I was not supposed to do. In Sri Lanka, I had written a lot of human interest stories, people getting new limbs, the displaced being resettled, grassroots peace activists running community centers. My job was to make donors feel good about what their money had achieved. So, although I never lied, I focused on the positive. Every life could have a new beginning. War was not all. Hope springs eternal. But in Kosovo, I was writing for internal consumption. My job was to stand apart from the thicket of propaganda and hysteria, to record barbarity. A murder, a mass grave, a firebombed church, a whole village expelled. With the same detachment I brought to an update on the electricity supply. I took to these communiques with an ease that surprised me. I understood the authority of this passion, and felt strangely at home in it. The dogs had rabies, I say. Wasn't that the story? That was the story, Harry says. But killing the dogs was a warning. The village was being cleared. Awful we should have met over a bunch of murdered dogs. When I think of Kosovo, Harry says, I think of dogs. Dogs everywhere. I know, I say. I know what you mean. The dogs in Pristina were all skinny as greyhounds, and they slithered along the dark streets in threes or fours, burying their snouts in the waist-high piles of stinking rubbish, snorting and sneezing, gnawing at God knows what. Those that weren't wild were kept chained by the neck in the yards of their owners, where they barked and bayed all through the night. When you passed, they would leap forward with shocking vigor before their chains yanked them back to earth. All that animal energy, grown twisted and violent from having for so long been denied any normal outlet. I had a dog of my own, a stray little mongrel who'd attached herself to me. I named her Betty. She had such a relentlessly happy disposition that she seemed a bit stupid. One day, when my friend Stephen was visiting, we took Betty to be spayed, which, in the context of Kosovo, where strays were shot or left to fend for themselves, seemed an act of pointless or excessive care. Stephen was Welsh. We had met in Sri Lanka. Around the time I went to Kosovo, he went to Juba in South Sudan. After that, we'd see each other three or four times a year. Either he came to visit me, or we met in some more pleasant location, the Dalmatian coast, or the Mediterranean. We were comfortable together, not heated or tortured, just good. I respected Stephen, respected his self-sufficiency. He could repair an engine and build a shelter out of nothing, and navigate by dead reckoning. He was like an explorer from the 19th century, someone most himself when alone. He'd go off on long solo safaris or extended cross-country ski treks. But the relationship lacked traction. It didn't have a trajectory. We were as close or as far from each other after 3 years as we'd been after a few months. Anyway, his plan was eventually to retire from this work and take up the family farm in Wales, and I had no desire to end up on a farm in Wales, with Stephen or anyone else. Still, I felt envious. I envied the way he inhabited his life. I thought he knew himself. Utterly. The vet was an Albanian from Tirana. His name was Bekim. He worked for the Department of Veterinary Services, and he told us we should come only after 6 p.m., which meant that he was pocketing the money. We arrived at 6:15. On the wall of Bekim's office were pictures of a horse, a parrot, a rabbit, and a goat, all made of cheap velvet material, and a poster showing an American flag. I told Bekim I wanted to watch the procedure, and he looked at me with interest and skepticism. He gave Betty a shot, and a few minutes later slit her open like an envelope and began pulling what looked like a long tongue out of her. Then he stopped, cursed, and tucked the tongue back into her, the way you'd tuck a tissue up your sleeve. I had no idea how things were meant to be unfolding, but this didn't look right. There was a lot of blood, dark, thick, purpley red, pooling on the table. I looked at Stephen. He raised his eyebrows, but didn't say anything. After some more rummaging around, Bekim extracted something glistening and stringy with his tongs. He started across the room with it, towards the garbage can, but then looked at me and stopped, and instead dropped it at his feet on the floor, as though issuing a challenge. The floor was already smeared with blood, and he was now operating with the dog's long stringy bits at his feet. I was afraid he was going to slip, or, worse, that he would step on them, and blood and other liquids would squirt out. Finally, he sewed up Betty's insides and stitched her skin. Then he stooped and picked up the stringy thing and laid it on the table. He pointed out the uterus. I looked at Betty. She was comatose, defenseless. I thought I had never seen a being more innocent. Bekim poked her gently in the face a few times with his finger and said, "She is taking the medicine a little too seriously." "You didn't kill her," I said, half joking. Bekim didn't answer, either because my question was absurd or because he considered the dog's death of negligible import. He motioned for Stephen to lift her off the table. I put an old blanket under her, and Stephen lowered her onto it and carried her to the car. Then he set her gently on the back seat. As we drove away in silence, I had the sense that we had shared in something elemental, a ritual of bloodletting. Harry asks me if I read about the horse and cattle carcasses that were found at the bottom of a cliff in Dunebeg last week. I did. Their ears had been cut off to remove identifying tags, and then they'd been pitched 300 feet from the cliff top. There were tire marks up to the edge of the cliff. The vet who examined them, there were 16 dead animals, said it had been hard to count them because their necks and legs were broken and their limbs were all tangled together and they were rotting. He said it was the worst job he'd ever had to do. We sat there gloomily in silence. Then Harry says that the difference between nations is the degree to which acts of everyday barbarity are tucked away, conducted out of sight, and that what we call civilization and what we know as peace is only the papering over of what we really are. Violent, venal, full of fear. There was a program on TV the other night that we both saw. It was about the sex trade in Ireland, now divided into outdoor prostitution, which sounds hale and vigorous, but just means standing on street corners, and indoor prostitution, which sounds cozy, but means the women have been trafficked from Eastern Europe and Nigeria, and are hustled from county to county, from brothel to brothel. There was CCTV footage of a few of them in a car park in Athlone, with their little wheelie suitcases and their cheap trainers, scurrying behind their pimp like dogs he was walking, but didn't much like. Harry says that if the nation were a rock we could lift, we'd be horrified by what we saw. The two of us are essentially in agreement on this, that human beings have an infinite capacity for cruelty. I say to him, I wish it were a happier world view we shared. I believe goodness exists, he says, and love. You do too. You loved your mother. And you've loved other people. Isn't that a world view? I don't know. I suppose. Of course it is. We order another glass of wine each. I met an old friend of Eddie's today, I say. Harry's eyes go wide. He knows that I was married, but nothing at all about the breakup. Really? Where? On Wicklow Street. He sips his wine. And how was that? Strange, I say. I never liked the guy, but it was one of those times when you stop to say hello because you're sure you know the person from somewhere, and by the time you realize who he is and where you know him from, and that you'd rather not talk to him, it's too late. So you spoke to him. Briefly, I asked about Eddie. And? He didn't say much. He did tell me Eddie had sold the house, the one we lived in. I asked him where Eddie was living now, and he just said he was still in the area, with his family. Harry can see the encounter has thrown me, though he doesn't know why, and I'm not sure myself. Why did he sell the house? Harry asks. No idea, I say. I didn't want to ask. I resented hearing about Eddie from this particular man, who I sensed was enjoying my discomfort. And I didn't want to give him the satisfaction of my curiosity. I was surprised at the twinge of possessiveness I felt. I had known, of course, that the house was for sale, but I hadn't anticipated that Eddie's leaving it would have any particular effect on me, that I would be unsettled by the fact that, suddenly, I had no idea where to picture him. Harry keeps eyeing me, but doesn't comment. He is doing that thing men sometimes do. You tell them something big and confusing, something that's really rocked you, the sort of thing that would make a woman scoot forward on her chair so that the two of you could parse the thing to death. And they say nothing. And you are never sure if they are holding it there, in silence and respect, letting you sort it the way they sort things, or if they are simply at a loss, unable to cross easily from the territory of information to the territory of feeling. By the time we leave the central, it has stopped snowing and doesn't even feel terribly cold. We walk together down to the corner of Dame Street, where the 24-hour spa is, with its plate glass windows that glare like a huge television. Harry kisses me, once on each cheek, and says, as always, mind yourself. And as always, after a few steps, I turn to watch him go. I worry about him in the city at night. Not just that he couldn't run if he had to. Does anyone really run from muggers? But that with all the drunkenness and the jostling, he might be knocked to the ground. I'm making him sound old or enfeebled, and he is neither, but it can be bedlam in this little knot of streets at night. When I get back to Monkstown, I go straight to the laptop and type in the address of Eddie's house, our old house. Sure enough, the place has sold. I go from website to website, everywhere it was listed, but the photos of the interior have been removed. A jolt passes through me, a kick of panic, as though someone has padlocked a place I'd half considered mine. It was midsummer before I told anyone about Coley. Camille had gone back to Toronto the previous autumn, and I saw less of Jane since Eddie and I had moved out of the town. Coley had told Kevin, and this made me nervous. Once, when Eddie and I were in Mulligan's having a rare drink in town, we bumped into Kevin. He was on his way to being drunk, and I kept catching him staring at me. "What did he say when you told him?" I'd asked Coley. "He said that Eddie was a sound guy." Coley looked almost sad. "Nice," I said. "A lot of people, men actually, said that about Eddie." It reminded me that Eddie had another world, the world of men, with its own clear codes and criteria. "So does that mean his loyalties are divided?" "Don't worry," Coley said. "We're friends since we were 6. The next time I met Kevin on the street, it was like meeting my gynecologist, a relative stranger who possessed knowledge of my most intimate life. I had no confidant of my own. Kevin was Coley's friend, and I resisted the temptation to unburden myself to him, to enjoy an hour devoid of duplicity. There were days when it felt as though my very thoughts were in knots, and there were other times I experienced a clear-headedness that brooked no doubt. But I was afraid this clarity was itself a delusion, an indication of how far from reality I had strayed. Was Coley only playing? Was I? And if we were, would we even know it? I had read an article recently about what people do when they get lost, in a city or when driving, or walking in a wilderness. There are identifiable stages, like the stages of grief, and, not surprisingly, the first is denial. That's when we bend the map, try to force the features we see before us to align with those indicated on a map, even though the correspondence between them is obviously poor. We focus on details that seem to confirm what we already believe to be true, and ignore evidence to the contrary. I thought, as I read, that this sort of reasoning was hardly confined to being lost, and in fact, probably directed the bulk of our life's decision-making. The more distinctive stages come when denial breaks down, when we can no longer pretend that we aren't lost. Adrenaline surges, panic sets in. Our perceptions become distorted. "When this happens," the article said, "it is best to stay put and engage in a quiet activity to calm the mind," which is, do I need to say it, the very last thing we are likely to do. Instead, we will choose from a handful of strategies, including backtracking, route sampling, and view enhancing. Deceptively rational-sounding terms for actions undertaken in alarm. The funny thing is that lost people, despite the fact that they often wander considerably long distances in their panicked peregrinations, are likely to be found relatively close to their last known position. In other words, they could just as profitably have stayed put and engaged in a quiet activity to calm the mind. The article had a short but terrifying sidebar on spatial disorientation among pilots, a condition in which perceptions no longer agree with reality. In order to give his non-pilot readers a point of reference, the writer began by referring to the common experience of sitting in a stationary train when an adjacent train pulls away, creating the sensation that we are moving backwards. He then went on to describe the myriad reason pilots become disoriented. Non-visible or false horizons, night flying over featureless terrain, the strange things maneuvers such as turning, banking, leveling, and climbing due to our vestibular system. There is a whole dark vocabulary of disorientation. The leans. The black hole approach illusion. The graveyard spiral. Many fatal accidents in private planes are the result of pilots lacking the training to fly with reference to instruments, or, out of inexperience or panic, trusting their perceptions over what the instrumentation is telling them. Upon finishing the article, I thought two things. That the key to being a successful liar was the ability to keep your nerve when your mind was playing tricks on you, and that the affair I was having might merely be a futile detour I was taking within my marriage, and in the end, I would wind up not the far side of anything, but right back where I'd started, with Eddie. I was in town when I bumped into Jane. I had come to turn in a piece I'd done for the local paper on the current state of a 20-year-long battle over a proposed relief road through town. This was the tail end of the old days, when things still happened in three dimensions, and I trudged into the office and handed them four typed pages, and I was headed to the phone box to ring Eddie, who I'd been trying to reach for the last 3 hours. I'd worked myself into a state of anxiety, convinced, not for the first time, that Eddie had found out everything, and needing desperately to hear his voice, to be reassured he hadn't. It was a terribly cheap feeling, and the relief that followed each time I got my reassurance was so great that it left me vowing, for a few hours, to forsake Collie. I saw Jane on the opposite corner of Wine Street. She spotted me at almost the same instant. She smiled, and then an odd look crossed her face, and she signaled that I should wait, and she would cross to my side. By the time she reached me, I was feeling the full wallop of a panic attack. Jane's voice sounded to me like it was coming from inside my own head. I looked down at the footpath, which quivered slightly, as though it might crawl away. "Are you okay?" she said. I don't know how people know what to do, how they know to just take you in hand and talk to you until it passes. But that's what Jane did. We stood on the street, and she stroked me like you would a cat, and after a minute or two I stopped shaking. She had a little place on Harmony Hill, and we went there and sat at her kitchen table, and I told her everything. Or almost everything. She listened very carefully, and when finally I paused, she said that she was incredibly sorry to hear all this, but that, to be honest, she wasn't shocked. I looked at her. There is nothing to make you feel foolish like someone telling you that your greatest secret is hardly a surprise. I remember the day you got married, she said. I was thinking what a strange thing love is. I mean strange like miraculous. Because it allows two very different people to see things in each other that aren't so apparent to anyone else.
You mean you thought it was far-fetched?
No, I thought the two of you were very different, that's all. When I say I'm not surprised, I don't mean I didn't think it could work. You know, she said, I've always thought he loved you. Any time I've seen you together, that's what I thought. I stayed at Jane's for a few hours. She cooked a stir-fry, and we talked about her job testing water up and down the West Coast, and then about a guy from Derry she'd been seeing. He was doing a PhD in environmental toxicology and had just come back from fieldwork in Indonesia. She showed me a photo of him. He had a beard and was standing on a beach in wet weather gear and a woolly hat, and he was smiling. He looked like one of those men who are instinctively at home in the elements. Her life seemed astonishingly clean to me, simple in the best sense, and my own, in comparison, seedy and scrambled. I put the picture down very carefully on the table and told Jane that I was happy for her. "What are you going to do?" she said, as though she hadn't heard me. I shook my head. "I don't know." The following day was Saturday, as Eddie and I puttered around the kitchen making coffee. He told me about a dream he'd had the night before. In the dream, he had jumped off a cliff. Or perhaps he'd been pushed. He couldn't be sure.
and he was flying, or floating, through the air, down, down, down. A little nervous, but mostly curious. Then, abruptly, he realized that he would never hit the ground, and he became more rather than less afraid. The thought that he would keep falling through space forever, that this was his eternity, horrified him. He said it was the most frightening dream he'd had in ages. I bent to pour some kibbles into Olivia's bowl and didn't look at him. I thought, he wants me to go. He feels us in a limbo that is worse than the worst resolution. I have become a burden. I have become, literally, a nightmare. A week later, I tried to leave him. I didn't say that I was leaving him. I told him I was going to Jane's for the night. I said a few of us were having dinner, and there'd be lots of wine, and I'd be better staying over. What I intended was to drive all the way to Dublin, check into a hotel, and call Eddie from there in the morning to tell him it was over. It was cowardly, but I reasoned that the amount of pain inflicted would, in the end, be hardly more than if I'd sat him down in our front room for the announcement. I hadn't told Collie either. Only after I'd phoned Eddie would I go to Collie's bedsit and reveal what I had done. In a strange way, all these convolutions and half-truths thrilled me. I felt as though I were finally taking hold of matters, making firm decisions. I hadn't allowed myself to think much beyond the moment of my arrival at Collie's, but I was enthralled to my vision of that moment, the intensity of feeling that would follow my delivering myself to Collie, the place it would assume in our mythology, any uncertainties about how Collie would receive me now that I was all his, were masked by my excitement. What I had managed to make myself believe was that, once the deed was done, whatever doubts Collie might have would evaporate. There would only be our future to embark on. I packed an overnight bag, just some essentials to get me through a few days. I'd have to come back for my things, of course. But that could be accomplished once the news had sunk in with Eddie. I seemed to have assumed that the practicalities of separating would be neatly split from the emotional storm, that there would be a linear progression of foreseeable phases, and that we would proceed through them with rationality and order. Around 8, I kissed Eddie goodbye in the front hall, and set off. As I descended the mountain road, faster than was wise, I felt as though the car might rise from the earth and become airborne. I was that giddy. I had to force myself to slow down. It was only when I was the far side of town that it began to dawn on me what I was doing. By the time I'd passed through Carrick-on-Shannon, I was asking myself if I really needed to go all the way to Dublin to accomplish my mission. Dublin seemed very far away, a point of no return. Perhaps I should carry on only as far as Longford. Then I thought of waking up in Longford, and it seemed no way to begin the rest of my life. I was some miles beyond Drummond when my heart began to race. I wanted to pull over, but I wasn't sure I should risk it on the shoulder, or how exactly to execute the move. I was traveling, along with everybody else, at about 100 kilometers per hour. In the space of an instant, I grew terrified of the fact of myself behind the wheel of a fast-moving car, and I thought, if I didn't get off the road immediately, I was going to lose control completely. A petrol station appeared, and I swerved into the forecourt and switched off the engine, breathless and drained of all bravado. I sat there for probably half an hour. The windows opened to the warm night, a homely rhythm to the scene. The comings and goings of cars to the petrol pumps, people in and out of the shop for cigarettes or sweets or a pint of milk. The faces of children, sleepy and dumbstruck in car windows. The shaking in my hands eased. My heartbeat slowed to normal. There was a sense of relief in discovering I hadn't the courage to go through with it. I thought of phoning Eddie. There was a phone box outside the little shop. I heard myself telling him that I was coming home. The good news, as though I'd been given the all clear after a health scare. The feeling, or some variation on it, was familiar. I'd felt it every time I came home after being with Collie. How close I'd come to peril and ruin, and how thrilling, suddenly, the safety of the hearth. Each time, in his innocence, Eddie looked precious to me all over again, and I was abject with tenderness. I started the car and pulled out of the petrol station and headed west, towards home. I stuck to the speed limit, and cars zoomed by me, driven by people who seemed frighteningly sure of themselves. When I pulled into our driveway, it was almost midnight. The mountain behind the house, huge and implacable. The moon was nearly full, and a few clouds floated by, mercury-colored in the moonlight. I went round to the kitchen door so as not to wake Eddie, along the path that ran beside the big back garden. We'd done nothing with the plans we'd drawn up for it that spring, and it was even wilder now, and more overgrown than it had been the day we'd bought the house. It had assumed an aura of the unapproachable, a monument to our mysterious inertia. And I sometimes imagined it growing and spreading until it engulfed the house itself. Eddie was in bed. I put my bag down at the foot of the stairs and went into the living room. I pulled the curtain and opened the sliding glass door, and moonlight spilled like smoke into the room. The front garden looked impossibly still. It was a small rockery, everything in it diminutive. The baby strawberries, dwarf heather that looked like bonsai shrubs, tiny purple petal flowers squeezing through the crevices. If the back garden was a jungle, there was a tension about the front. It was all control, tightness, denial. I thought of the woman who owned the house before us, the woman with anorexia. When we'd first moved in, I used to imagine I could feel her here. She'd left a lot of herself behind, in the form of objects and decor, but also an air of malaise that didn't lift until we'd stripped nearly every literal remnant of her existence away. Only the rockery served as a reminder. Eventually, I climbed the stairs and got into bed. Eddie stirred but didn't wake, and I pressed against his broad back, feeling small and depleted. The days after that were tentative and muted, as though we were awaiting news of some kind. I wasn't sleeping well. It felt more like jet lag than insomnia, abetted by the summer light. I never got used to the seasonal fluctuations at that latitude, the 20-hour days of summer, going to bed when there was still light in the sky. I would crawl, exhausted, between the sheets at 10 o'clock, then wake at 3 or 4 and lie there tossing, my mind as restless as if I were on stimulants, as the dawn bled bluish-white into the room. Around 6, I would fall again into a deep sleep, waking groggy and rueful, having slept, once again, through Eddie's dressing and departure. One evening, after a hot, heavy rain, I said that I was going for a walk. It was about 8 o'clock. There was an unusual light, lime-tinted, which was making everything, the trees and grass, the hedges, the one house opposite us, appear backlit and artificial, like pieces in a stage set. I wanted to be out in it and away for a few minutes from Eddie. The following afternoon, he was flying to the south of England on business, and I was heading to Dublin to be with Collie for 2 whole days. As always, just before I saw Collie, I was jangled, woozy with anticipation. When I said I was going for a walk, Eddie said, "I'll come." My heart quickened. I nearly said, "Why?" "Okay," I said meekly. I opened the door, and Olivia shot out, looked in both directions with a twitch, and headed off at a canter up the back garden. When we were on the road, Eddie took my hand and said, out of the blue, "I was thinking maybe mid-September we might go to see your mother and Stan."
"Really?"
I took this in.
"You'd go too?"
My mother and Eddie loved each other, and he and Stan got on well. But usually Eddie was working, and I went alone to Florida. I was aware I'd sounded uninviting, and added, "Can you take holidays?"
"I should be able to."
"That would be great," I said, though what I felt was terror. Terror that, come September, none of this would exist. Terror that my mother would never look at me in the same way again. Terror, yes, this too occurred to me, that Eddie and my mother had spoken and decided I needed to get away, and that some kind of intervention was on the cards. Perhaps Eddie meant to leave me there, return me to my mother, like merchandise that had not performed as promised. Oh, I had so much shame that summer. "We could rent a car," he said. "Take them down to the Keys.
They'd love that,
I said, staring straight ahead at the dark bank of trees at the T-junction the far end of our road. She and Stan used to go to Key West.